Good evening, everyone. I'm Ugetsu, and we are just about at the end of our winter Ango period. On Sunday, we're going to have a great ceremony. Our Shuso will be celebrated in a lovely ceremony where he'll get to give a talk. And people will get to question him on his talk. So if you haven't been to one of our, well, I'm talking to most of the converted here, but let's enjoy this one too. So I've been wanting to take a shot at the Song of the Jewel Mirror Awareness. It's a lovely, lovely poem. A very everyday poem, and that's one of the things I so appreciate about it. And I had signed up for a talk during this week because it's my spring break. I spend my life between two professions, filmmaker and college professor. So I thought, well, let me give a talk during spring break because I won't be so stressed out. Preparing for my classes so I can really take a look at Song of the Jewel Mirror Awareness, and more importantly, have a look at who we say is its author, Dongshan. He is one of our great ancestors, came to being in the 9th century. And one of the things I appreciate about him is awakening didn't necessarily come easily to him. He spent his younger years wandering all around China, going between Chan masters. Chan would become Zen in China, in Japan. And so he hung out with the Chan masters and the hermits, and he tried to further his understanding of Buddhism. And he would end up studying with three important teachers for him, two of them quite notable, Nansen and Guishan, and another teacher who was particularly helpful, but maybe not as well known, Yongyan. And since I'm on spring break, I thought, and I spend so much of my life at this point has been teaching, and it's not necessarily the part of me that, or the part, the profession that I spend as much time looking at. But I want to look at teachers, Dongshan, Guishan, Yunyan, this method of subtle awakening, subtle teaching that we have. I think it's a great gift. That there is this very intimate method of bringing a student to realize themselves. You know, as opposed to saying, just memorize the sutra, or this is the way it is. Because it can't be the same for everybody. It's a very personal, thing. And I think Dongshan's struggle as a student made him, or at least the amount of teachers he worked with, I don't know if he struggled, I'm sure he did because we all do. But I'm sure this all made him appreciate the student-teacher relationship. And in particular, how the teacher preps the student so that they may, on their own accord, have this pivotal moment where everything falls into place. But they don't give them the answer. One of his favorite teachers, Yongyan, as I mentioned before, he wasn't necessarily well known. And at one point, a monk asked Dongshan, you know, you studied something to the effect of, you studied with Nansen and Guishan. These are major teachers of that time. You know, what made Yongyan so great? And he said, I do not esteem my late teacher's virtues or his Buddhist teaching. I only value the fact that he didn't explain everything for me. Yunyan's method was subtle, tailored towards his student. He didn't explain it. And I think the appreciation Dongshan had was then integrated into his own teaching methods. And I could just say that Enkyo Roshi was my college professor back in the mid 80s. And one of the things I always appreciate about her, even then, you know, she wasn't called Enkyo. I don't even know if she was. She definitely wasn't Roshi. I don't know if she was even Enkyo yet. She was Pat. But the thing I really liked about Pat was that she didn't resort to ideological or formal methods. Her method was to support and encourage the student, encourage me, until I found my own way. And I always valued that about her, and I think that's why over the years I ended up entering into Zen study, just because I ran into her on the street and I thought, what a great person to learn from. So why not? And I try and integrate her methods into my own teaching, although I'm a little bit more bossy and I tend to tell people what to do. So I'm still trying. Another one of the things I appreciate about Dongshan is how he used these personal stories of not quite getting it. He used his stories of confusion as koans, as teaching tools. In other words, he didn't hold himself up to be some great paragon. He just said, oh, you think you're struggling. When I asked my teacher, when Dongshan asked Guishan whether non-sentient beings could extol the Dharma, Guishan simply held up his whisk. And, you know, that's always happening. Roshi will sometimes do something subtle like that. And it can be infuriating because, you know, what? What is it? What are you saying? He asked for more explanation. And Guishan told him, it can never be explained to you by means of one born of a mother or father. You can't explain it. It has to come from within. He didn't give him the answers. So still searching, Dongshan went off to study with Yunyan. And he actually made a great deal of progress with Yunyan, but he still hadn't come quite to that point where he entered an awareness of the great reality, let's put it that way. So as he was leaving after a period of time, after studying with Yunyan, he asked, later on, if I'm asked to describe your reality, how should I respond? Yunyan paused and said, just this is it. Just this is it. But, you know, that it's such a profound, our profundities can be so subtle. And in this case, Dongshan was kind of distracted and didn't quite take it in. He said his goodbyes and he headed off. And as he was journeying to his next location, he was crossing the stream, and just then he saw his reflection in the water. And it happened, that pivotal moment happened for him. He merged. Instead of saying, you know, or feeling the same binary, subjective, objective binary, he merged with all that is. He had his own awakening. And he wrote this simple poem that to me is, it's a touchstone. I return to it over and over again. Beware of seeking the truth from others. Further and further he retreats from you. Alone I go now, all by myself, and I meet him everywhere I turn. He is no other than myself, and yet I am not he. When this is understood, I am face to face with Tathagata, or just this. So in that moment, just in that moment, catching his reflection on the stream, on the surface of the stream, you know, it wasn't a moment of, oh God, I look awful. It was everywhere I meet it. It's a much larger moment. It's a very everyday moment, and that's another thing I really appreciate about this. You know, you're walking down Broadway and all of a sudden you catch your reflection in a store window merged with, you know, all the people moving in this blur by you. And just, oh, wow, just this. So I've taken this time during working with the Jewel to just think a little bit, inquire a little bit about these pivotal everyday moments. And one of these moments has come up recently when we got this cat, okay? My partner Lori decided that it was time to get a cat. And I love cats, I've always had them, but I didn't know if I was quite ready, but I said, oh, okay, all right. And so we went to a sanctuary, a cat sanctuary, and we were looking for an orange kitten. It was the only thing that we agreed on is it had to be orange. And I think we were very aware of trying to not turn against this color. Orange is good, orange. So we didn't find any kittens, but in the corner, perched up on a bed, was this big orange tomcat. And he was very sweet. He was offering his head. He has a head the size of a pumpkin, and he was offering this head to us, and we were petting him. And, you know, he said, okay, all right, we'll give up the kitten. We're going to get Chili. Chili is the name of this cat. And so we brought him home. And this is not uncommon. I mean, he was very friendly and everything in the sanctuary, but when we got him home, he freaked. He just became very skittish. He was hiding under the bed. He wasn't really into letting us pet him the way we had in the sanctuary. And I found it so very upsetting to have this creature in the house that was unhappy. So, you know, I found myself for hours laying by the bed, talking to him as he was under it, and just trying to say, you know, come on, Chili, come out, come on, come on, Chili. And it just, that wasn't working, treats weren't working, nothing seemed to be working. And it was exhausting. But probably in the spirit of that exhaustion, one day when he was just laying on one side of the bed, I just lay down on the other side, very gently, very quietly, and I just laid there for a while. And over time, I put my hand out, and I didn't try and pet him. I just very lightly made contact with the side of this cat, just kept my hand there for a long time. And after a bit, he didn't move. He was aware I was there, because after a while, he started lightly purring. And this was just very relaxing. For the first time, I was really relaxing with this cat. And we both fell asleep. And when I woke up, he was still there, leaning against my hand. And just this moment of gentle inquiry, of both of us just being present to each other, not trying to inflict myself on him, not trying to get him to do anything, just a moment of contact, did so much. You know, I spent the day, I spent actually the week with Chili on my break, just, you know, he was sitting in my lap. He's gotten so much more affectionate just from these first forays into just being present, watching what's happening in the moment. It's just a very everyday kind of moment. And I think each of us have these everyday kinds of moments, but I don't know about you, but I've found it more challenging. I've been challenged after the election. I found myself getting kind of aggravated or getting immersed in a lot of political discussions that could bring up lots and lots of emotions. And there's nothing wrong with that, but after a while, you get so riled up that it's hard to pay attention to just what's happening every day in your life. And so I think it's even more important to practice intimately with our lives. And also to recognize that this is not new. It's the Song of the Jewel Mirror Awareness was written during a great time of, or during an awful time of great persecution in China. There was a great anti-Buddhist persecution movement initiated by the Tang Emperor Wuzong. And it hit right around the time that Dongshan was reaching his height as a teacher. In late middle life. And the thing about the great anti-Buddhist persecution was its goals were to build up war funds and to purge China from foreigners. And this struck me because it sounds so familiar, you know? It's kind of where we're at. Get rid of the foreigners and build up the military. You know, I'm sure that Emperor Wuzong, his motto was probably something very much like make Tang Dynasty great again. You know, that's what he was trying. This was his method. So Dongshan and his students were working with this very subtle, beautiful song at a time when they themselves were being persecuted. And for me, I take great solace in that, in knowing that. They weren't on some mountain in separated from this awful time. You know, the emperor at that time was trying to clean out the monasteries because these men in the monasteries weren't contributing taxes. They weren't contributing to the dynasty. So, and they were leaving their families, they were begging. They weren't really necessarily providing for the greater good of the dynasty. So even in those times, he taught his poem, his little poem about being awakened by the water. And as I return to that poem, it reminds me of another great poem, is my favorite, by Walt Whitman. And it was written just a mile from here, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. It's a wonderful poem. I can't do the whole poem here, but there are parts of it that I wanted to go back to and share in light of Gongshan. You know, Brooklyn Ferry is exactly where Brooklyn Bridge is now. And it was just as much the thoroughfare then that it is now. So today the poem would be Crossing Brooklyn Bridge. But Whitman begins, "Flood tide below me, I see you face to face. Clouds of the west, sun there, half an hour high, I see you face to face." I love this opening because he's looking at his reflection in the water. You know, it's very much like Dongshan's small poem. He's seeing himself in the water, but he's not seeing just himself in the water. He's seeing the clouds. He's seeing the sun going down. He's seeing something much greater than that. He's not even just seeing, he's feeling it. And he continues, "Crowds of men and women attired in the usual costumes. How curious you are to me. On the ferry boats, the hundreds and hundreds that cross, returning home, are more curious to me than you suppose. And you that shall cross from shore to shore years hence are more to me and more in my meditations than you might suppose." And here's where I really like about the poem, because from his historical position in 1855, he's talking to you right now. Past and present, he's bridging that with his words. And in my favorite part, he's saying to us, "Just as you feel when you look on the river and sky, so I felt. Just as any of you is one of a living crowd, I was one of a crowd. Just as you were refreshed by the gladness of the river and the bright flow, I was refreshed. Just as you stand and lean on the rail, yet hurry with the swift current, I stood, yet was hurried." He's calling to a commonality in our experiences, this joining with us in this present moment right now. And that's evident in the way the final two lines of the poem, where he says, "You furnish your parts towards eternity. Great or small, you furnish your parts towards the soul." I love that word, furnish. You know, to furnish your apartment is a very personal act. You go into a room and you make it your home. You add yourself to it and it becomes you. It becomes your home. So this idea of you furnish your parts towards eternity, it's your personal expression. You furnish that towards eternity. And in that personal moment, you join with something vast. Crossing Brooklyn Ferry is seen as a poem, a joyous poem that is, you know, celebrating the great one soul. Yet Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, again, it's one of these poems. It was written in 1855. This country was roiling. It was about to split in two. Everybody was worked up because of the fugitive slave law that had been recently reenacted. It was a horrific law. It meant even if you were in the North and you knew of a runaway slave, if you did not turn them in, or if you aided or abetted them in any way, you could be fined a phenomenal fine. I think it was $2,500, which at that time was quite large, or thrown in jail. So, you know, just imagine being dead set against slavery and then having, you know, your government insist on this law as some kind of compromise that was going to keep us all together. It was an awful time. Our nation was coming apart, and in 5 years, Whitman himself would be in a hospital on the front line of the Civil War, and he would be holding the hands of dying men and bringing the injured notepaper and pens and sweets, and even writing letters to the family of soldiers who succumbed to their illness. So he too had to call on his tools, his personal tools, to get him through a very challenging time, to bear witness in a way that only he could, his personal way, but to join an effort of everyone who could. And I think there's a great lesson in that, because all of us here in this room have a tool set, a very personal tool set that for one reason or another, we've accumulated throughout the course of our lives. And whatever this tool set is, it's made us either a good teacher, a good parent, a good poet, a good guardian, a good gardener, artist, even, you know, I hate to say it, but a good politician. And I guess what I take away, my most precious takeaway from the song of the Jewel Mirror Awareness is this call to find our own songs, each of us, moment by moment, even in challenging times. Just a call to appreciate this unique scrim that we are.